You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
It's an incredible story, and it kind of blew my mind as I was going through the process of writing it. And if you read the book, you'll see that I kind of take readers on the same journey that I went through, because what happened was there's a guy, ordinary guy, lives in Auckland, a businessman, moderately successful. And one day he woke up and he found that on the Whale Oil blog, which was a very successful blog around about 2012, it was the biggest blog in New Zealand. It had hundreds of thousands of readers, run by a guy called Cameron Slater. My guy, Matt Blomfield, woke up one morning and found that on the Whale Oil blog was a series of articles beginning all about how awful Matt was. And it painted Matt in a terrible picture. It showed him to be a fraud and a pornographer and into drugs. And it just went on and on. And it ended up with there being well over 100 articles altogether, all about how terrible Matt was. And it had a devastating effect on Matt's life. His friends fell away, all his business opportunities dried up. He had been bankrupted a couple of years earlier, but he'd been clawing his way back and was allowed to work again. But with the onslaught of the Whale Oil articles, Matt got a call from the official assignee, which is the government body that oversees bankruptcies and which had given him permission to work again, and said, "No, you stop work right now. You're not allowed to work." And Matt said, "Why?" And they said, "Because of the Whale Oil articles." So everything about his life just kind of ground to a halt. And it quickly became apparent that what the articles were based on was 10 years' worth of Matt's own stolen material, his digital files, and also four filing cabinets drawers with hard copies in them. And somehow Slater had got hold of this stuff, and he was using it as the proof of what he was writing about Matt, but they would be subtly changed. So they looked really bad. They looked real, but they looked really bad. And so Matt, I mean, you can imagine what that would be like. It's really like, it's like Kafka. It's like everywhere you look, there's just weirdness and surreality. And he just didn't know what to do. And he wasn't a lawyer, and he had no opportunity to work. And he basically had nothing to lose. And a lawyer friend of his said, "Well, you could take a defamation action against Slater, and you can do some of these things called judicial reviews to try and get back your right to work." And Matt was like, what's that? But he's really a smart, smart guy. And he went and started reading. He read all these legal judgments and went into court and watched to see what happens in court, how lawyers act, how judges act. And he swung into action, and he took legal action against Slater to try and get the articles taken down and to try and get some redress and the acknowledgement that what Slater had written wasn't true. And that was 7 years ago. It took 7 years.
Wow.
And it was an incredible journey.
And it's still not finished, right?
Almost finished, but no, it's not finished. And so at the end of last year, he started to have some real victories. There was a week-long High Court hearing in which the judge dismissed everything about Slater's defence and said there was no defence to Slater, for Slater. So that was a huge victory. Also, the Human Rights Review Tribunal, because Matt had gone through the Privacy Commission path as well, and the Privacy Commission handed it up to the Human Rights Review Tribunal, and they took 4 years to make their decision, but they came through and said it was a total character assassination and there was no basis for it, and they fined Slater $70,000, which Matt would probably never see. So there were all these validations and victories coming through, but it took him 7 years, and so the book kind of documents that journey, and it's awful and also kind of just relentless. And yeah,
I have to just say, because the book is called Whale Oil, and it's about Cameron Slater, but the story itself is Matt's, right? This is a story about Matt, who I have to admit I had never heard of before this book.
And you wouldn't have, because he's not a famous person. He's not a named person. He was just a guy going about his daily business. A guy who was married, he had a couple of young kids. He was, at that point he was in his 30s. He was just trying to make his way in the world. And then this happened, and it's like, well, why?
Mm.
There was no public reason for it. And anyway, what unfolded, what became apparent was that Matt was the victim of of a conspiracy, which is a hugely loaded word and a word that, you know, you can't hear without feeling kind of suspicious and doubtful. But this is a clear example of a conspiracy. It turns out that Slater was paid to write the articles about Matt by a guy that Matt had been in business with but had fallen out with, who had had access to all Matt's stuff and had passed them to Slater and a little group of people. They called themselves Operation Bumslide, and they met together and went through all Matt's stuff and plotted out the lines of the attack articles. Mm. And Slater was paid one way or another, and the articles appeared on Whale Oil.
So a lot of the content, and I guess just the way that Cameron works as well, is a very personal attacks, it seems. The way that he writes is very personal. So what you uncover also in this book, but was also talked about in Dirty Politics, was the way that Cameron is paid to do this work. So you talk about him in the book, so I'll name him, Warren Powell. Mm. And this is the person that, at least, and I have to say, I haven't finished the book, so I don't actually know what it is. So I don't want to say that this is all, you know, conclusive, at least from my perspective. Mm. But it's alleged that he is the one who orchestrated this whole thing. Mm. And the question, I suppose, you are asking in the book is why, what was Warren's vendetta, right? That's the question. Am I right?
Yeah. Actually, when I first started working on this, so maybe just backtrack a little bit. Where the story comes from is, so you mentioned Dirty Politics, that Nikki Hager's book that came out in 2014, and that revealed exactly that Cameron Slater took money to run articles on his blog that looked like real news but were actually paid for by representatives, you know, indirectly by representatives from, you know, significant industries like alcohol and tobacco and sugar, groceries, you know, that kind of stuff, and had relationships with really important political figures and relationships that went right up to the Prime Minister's office. And Nikki Hager sort of revealed this whole thing. And so my book literally is a footnote within Dirty Politics. Okay. It's on page 12. And when Dirty Politics came out, and Matt was already 2 years into his battle against Slater, he was like blown away. You know, my God, it's someone else is taking on, right, you know, my enemy. And he'd never heard of Nikki Hager before, but he rushed out and bought a book and looked through it and found himself on page 12, just this little mention of Cameron boasting to someone that he had 12 gigabytes of information about a businessman. And so Matt rang Nikki and was, you know, introduced himself, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that conversation in a minute. But basically from there, Matt and Nikki met. Even Nikki was wary of Matt to begin with. You know, there was all this shit written about him, but over time got to know Matt and really, really rates him, really trusts him. And at some point, Nikki said to Matt, "I think you've got an incredible story. I think you know you should tell it." Yeah.
Sorry, can I interrupt? Because I want to come back to that suspicion thing, but you're right, I did sort of race ahead. I did have a whole kind of section on Nikki and Dirty Politics. It was it was more that I wanted to mention that, obviously, Nikki, he's written the foreword in your book.
Yeah.
And actually, what a weird thing that happened at the airport on the launch, or the day before the launch. And
that's so weird.
That was very weird. So somebody, I can't remember who, sorry, was carrying a manuscript of the book.
Matt, actually.
Matt was. My God. Yeah, okay, so this is how I didn't even know him before this. Yeah, okay, so the person who the book is about was travelling through the airport, and he got held up by airport security wanting to know what the book was about. Anyway, okay.
Yes, it was very peculiar. He was coming back from a holiday, and he had the manuscript, and it was a heavily embargoed book, and he was pulled out of the line, him and his two daughters and their young friend, and 2 hours they went through everything, and they found the book, and they were like, "What's it called? What's it called? What's the title?" And they said they would fine him $1,000 if he didn't tell them the title.
Wow.
Yeah, there's stuff, it's very, very strange. But just yet another strange thing. Another, a lot of strange
thing
things
that he's
happen,
had to
yeah.
sort of face. Okay, well, because I also didn't want to necessarily, I didn't want to take away from either book, because Dirty Politics and Whale obviously have a relationship, but they're also very sort of separate stories. So I was just going to ask you perhaps what is it that relates them and what makes them separate, if that makes sense.
I suppose, I mean, the obvious thing is Slater himself, and, you know, and that the ability to use a powerful digital media tool in a really destructive way. And so that's kind of the common thing. I mean, that's what Nikki revealed in Dirty Politics in very creepy sort of dark politics ways. And then the damage that can be done to individuals by this kind of thing. And I guess Matt is not your classic victim profile. You know, he's a Pakeha male, middle class sort of guy, and yet this terrible, terrible thing happened to him. I mean, we're more used to thinking of victims of hate speech as being particular demographic groups, you know, and it's that's a horrific thing to think about. You know, women, minorities, you know, Māori, are often the victims of hate speech. But here we have, you know, actually it can happen to anybody in a way, and the damage it can do to an individual. And I think that's, I mean, I got to really like Matt. I really respect him and regard him as a friend. But at the same time, his story to me was kind of a thing in itself, but also representative of these bigger issues.
So, okay, on that then, let's go into, because I've got, I suppose, two quotes. I mean, Nikki talks about your book saying it's a sobering story of how few protections there are in the digital age against these kinds of attacks. And then you've said Matt's case demonstrates sharply how we are not adequately protected within our super-connected new world. And this is sort of a major, major part of the story where during the years that this was happening, Matt just, there was nothing to protect him.
Yeah.
And there were bits and pieces that were happening maybe around him, but nothing that kind of meant that right at that very moment he could have been protected. I mean, that leads into the kind of big conversation around fake news as well that I want to touch on. But I guess I'm now probably cut this right to the beginning because it is the beginning. It's about the way that you began this journey, and you've said it already, but the suspicion that you had, like Nikki had, when you're first kind of introduced to Matt and the fact that there are these horrible things on the internet about him. So of course, naturally, you have some suspicion when being approached by him, or when you initially start talking to him. And actually what I find quite, because now just listening to you in person talking about Matt, you speak about him with such generosity and kindness and respect, and you tell his story from a certain perspective, one who has, you know, told the story over however long you've told the story and you've engaged with him. And so one might say that, I mean, you could be biased, but actually you could also say that you have all the information and therefore you are telling a true, an accurate representation of the story. Those who read the blog, though, don't have that information and are taking, you know, what they get from this blog. And I mean, that in itself, right, is a big issue with politics generally these days and our democratic ways of sort of engaging, actually. That's a huge kind of lead up to, I suppose, our question. But in the sense that you and yourself, your process to write this book was an investigation, and you uncovered, I mean, you had to deal with massive amounts of information. So maybe if you can, whatever you took from that little rant, but talk about how important it is that we actually have all of the information, essentially, when making a decision. That's kind of where I'm getting to.
Yeah, I mean, it is really important, and we can't always get access to information, and we can't always know whether what we're reading is true. And so that is definitely a problem in this age. You know, we probably have more access to more information than any generation in the whole history of humanity, and in a way, and that's seen as a good thing, you know, that we can look up anything we want. And yet at the same time, I wonder whether the sheer bulk of it has kind of dulled our criticality, or, you know. And also, I mean, I guess something about it is like that we're really babies when it comes to this stuff. We are the first generation to coexist with the internet, and we're really feeling our way, and that's on the individual level and on the institutional level. So, I mean, if we look at the institutional level, which is what Matt came up against, you know, he had these things said about him on this blog, and people, an enormous number of people, including people in authority, believed what was written. They just, you know, no smoke without fire. You tend to believe what's, you know, what's under your nose. And that shaped the assistance that Matt was able or not able to get. And there's quite good evidence that two of the really key police officers involved in the inquiry, you know, that Matt went to the police for help. But it looks like they'd read Whale Oil and they thought Matt was a crook. So there wasn't any help coming from there. And he made many attempts over the years, including at a later stage he got his system was hacked again in 2014. The police wouldn't even take a complaint from him about that. So he was very unsupported in that way. So I think that the institutions charged with protecting us have not quite grappled or grasped. They haven't quite grasped what can happen out there online, you know. And I think there needs to be a much more sophisticated understanding of just the way that harm can happen. And it's still going on, actually, because there's a Samoan journalist called Lani Young, and she's been really harassed online. There's been a lot of hate speech against her. I read something just yesterday, actually, where she'd gone to the police with her complaints, and they basically said, well, have you stopped writing the kinds of articles that inspired this kind of response?
What?
You know, maybe that would keep you safer.
Wow.
So actually, you know, I up until reading that, I would have said, you know, the stuff that happened with Matt began in 2012, you know, I would hope that they might be a little bit more clued up by now, but I'm not at all convinced they are. No.
That's devastating.
It's shocking.
I'm sort of not surprised because I'm, again, like you say, there are things that are coming out and people, and it might even be the same person, but in terms of reading, you know, responses saying, well, you should not be online or you should not say the things
online. Take yourself
offline. It's
you
like,
know.
Well, then who are you deciding who gets to participate in
exactly.
that, in anything,
yeah.
really?
So it's not an answer, is it?
No.
And so another thing that actually is kind of slightly off to the side of my book, but I think it's really important in terms of our responses as individuals to all this stuff, is that we can actually upskill ourselves as individuals in this area. And there's a role here for those of us who belong to less harassed groups, perhaps. I mean, there's a program that's being run out of Action Station, which called Tau Iwi Totoko. And they're training volunteers to go online, look at the comment threads and articles where there's a lot of nasty hate stuff going on, and just try and sort of empathise, try and bring the tone of the discussion down a bit and try and open it up so people are in a better emotional state to listen to each other. Because, you know, I think we're all a bit guilty of quickly inflamed rage when we read stuff online, and it's really easy to jump in and be just as inflamed and almost abusive as the people whose opinions you don't like. And I think we can all take a bit of responsibility for just trying to bring the emotional level down and listen to each other a bit more. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And I'm also jumping all over the place now just because there's different
Sorry,
threads.
Sorry, yes, I do. I go off
No,
these
that's
tangents.
Okay. So I'll go back to the fake news later. I just want to touch on because I had your point about the way that the police sort of treated people very differently, the way that they responded to Matt's complaints, but even using Nikki's example of all of, you know, his police raid, basically. So even just it's not new that police treat people differently in the sense that, you know, of course there's bias, there's all of that scholarship out there talking about that, but actually just in the very concrete ways of perhaps understanding how to deal with something that you're not aware of how to deal with, I suppose. Is that an excuse for the police at this point?
No, I don't think it is, because they...
Because you talk about the police as being indifferent and impatient very early on towards Matt.
They were, yeah. I mean, I think that, I mean, it's hard to separate an institutional culture from the behaviour of individuals, isn't it? And it's really hard to know the truth of that. And you know, I do think that the police, you know, to their credit, have made some big advances in some areas. Like, I mean, if we look at, you know, the way that they've dealt with the victims of domestic violence, for instance, and rape, they take that a lot more seriously now. And that's a cultural shift within the police, and it's not perfect, but it's definitely something that they acknowledge and do take steps to make sure that they're behaving, you know, that they're dealing with it in the right way. So that's an institutional culture thing. So, and I wondered within this if it was an institutional culture, just this kind of lack of empathy. You know, there was just no acknowledgement. Even if they thought there was no legal case to answer, there wasn't a breath of sympathy to this person whose entire life was being spread all over the internet. It was, I just, often when I was researching this, I'd be reading through police files and I would just start to feel this really visceral kind of reaction. You know, my heart would start pumping because it's just so unfair.
Yeah. You know? And it's because, I mean, you even question in the book, you talk about the social contract. You were just like, this, I mean, isn't this what we sign up to?
Absolutely.
Why is that not happening?
I know, that and that's right. And that was quite a light bulb for me because I thought, well, maybe I'm just being over emotional and silly about this. But actually, no, this is the deal we strike. We pay our taxes, we obey the laws, we're good, and we don't carry guns around and weapons. But in return for that, we expect the state and, you know, these arms of the state to take care of us and be there when we need them.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.